So the position of Commandant was well understood, and the medical services in Ethiopia were under an Ethiopian medical directorate, but they had a Colonel McLean seconded from the military who was a doctor, and he was theoretically in charge of getting the supply and the funds and responsible for our overall activity. And our leader, Richie Mounsey, who was commandant, he did all the negotiating with government, etc., on our behalf. He had a deputy commandant, a friend of mine, Jack Fraser, who is now dead, and who after, 2 years in Ethiopia, I think, and his job was mainly administrative, and I do believe that he had some doubts about his pacifist role, but felt that he would he was really saddled down with administrative work, and expressed a wish to be transferred nearer the seat of military operation in the Middle East. And I do think he felt that he was too far removed from what was going on in the heat of battle. And he complained in a way that all you chaps are doing interesting things out in the country and here am I stuck on administrative work. Anyway, much to our sadness, he left. And he was a very, very nice man. And therefore, I was appointed deputy commandant and got an assistant to run the leprosy camp and an assistant to do the clinic and take over the what was then in the last year an administrative role. And also we could see that this was 44, and we knew that our time in Ethiopia probably wouldn't last more than another couple of years. And so several people wanted to be transferred. One or two were transferred to relief work in following the British invasion. And so there were arrangements of either transfer to other fields or preparing for handover. And that was quite an administrative work there. So I suppose in my last year there, my work was mainly administrative.
Could you tell me what the main problems were? You know, I was wondering if you had problems of bureaucracy to cope with that you would have come face to face with in your new role.
I think really it was all born of desperate shortage of funds and what in our judgment was probably wrong priorities on the use of those funds. But in retrospect, I now see that any government with limited funds have just taken back their country from a war situation has to have priorities. And so, whereas we felt they'd been not sympathetic enough and rather took us for granted, we kept on saying, for example, to the Ethiopian minister and finally to Haile Selassie himself that we weren't here forever and we'd kept the medical services at least an embryo going, but that unless his government was now recruiting doctors from the rest of the world, was training doctors, was training teachers, all we were doing was first aid treatment, and that when we go, it'll all disintegrate. And that was our concern. I think, unfortunately, a lot of it did disintegrate after we left. But those were largely then the physical administration of getting supplies to the clinic, which I'd been doing anyway, and then arranging for people who wanted to transfer to the Middle East or whatever, routine things like cooperating with the military to get them out on trucks and onto a certain boat. And you did have to conform with the military. I mean, wherever our group went, the military insisted that there was a known leader who were they were going to hold responsible. So this title is commandant and deputy commandant, and you had to use the term leader. For example, if you sent only four or five people up through Egypt on a boat, the military wanted to know who was the nominated leader. But that was administrative. Obviously, there were five individuals who were sort of free to do whatever they wished.
Well, were there many who wanted to leave Ethiopia and get into other fields then?
No, I think in total about five.
How many of those would have gone into the services, do you think?
Oh, I think there was one who went into the services that I know of, and another one that went to the Middle East, and from the Middle East went into the services. So I suppose there were two or three who, in the end, ended up. To my knowledge, ended up joining the military finally. There were three or four who... And, of course, I think psychologically the change came. So when was the invasion of Europe? Was that 44?
Yes, June of 44. Mm.
And I think it was hearing about this and their feeling that either they felt frustrated where they were, or they'd had 2 years of this and were wanting a natural change. They heard that there was great relief work to be done there, either in Italy or the Middle East itself per se was, I think, over by this time, wasn't it? Although Syria still on?
It was coming towards the end, that wasn't
it? Yeah. So anyway, I think several of them ended up in Europe. But that wouldn't account for more than six out of the 44 or whatever. Are you talking to any of the doctors on this? You are. Who?
You are our first Ethiopian.
Oh, I see.
So, you know, from this one we will now go into the other areas. I was wondering also, I remember reading in Tegla Davis about, you know, you've explained about the role with the schools.
Yes.
Although I don't think you were explicitly involved with
No.
But did you have anything to do with the prisons, Ethiopian prisons?
I didn't personally, but I know that in several of the prisons, the unit acted as the medical officer. And I know that in several instances, they got into hot water with the authorities, that's the Ethiopian authorities, for criticizing the barbaric treatment of some of the prisoners. Because the justice there was very much eye for eye, tooth for tooth. And I remember as a unit, our commandant complained officially to Haile Selassie about public executions because the justice there was very much on the basis that if you're caught, you're dealt with very brutally. And on this occasion, there'd been a bomb explosion which had killed several people. But they had captured the alleged perpetrators, and there was a public hanging in Addis Ababa out of about six. And the gibbets were erected, and the people were taken on their lorries and strung up one after the other. And there was one literally about 10 yards outside the clinic where I worked at Tekla Haimanot. And we felt this was a pretty barbaric way of justice, and our commandant, who was a very outspoken chap, said that he felt with great regret that a country that had been liberated from barbarism had to deal like this. I think he got pretty short shrift. But to go back to your immediate question, we did act as medical orderly officers to several of the prisons. But I think this was really just regarded as another sort of outpatient or routine routine visit.
When did the unit start to sort of pack up in Ethiopia?
45, early 45, spring of 45, people were being transferred. Some were going back direct to UK, others were going to Europe, several were going to Middle East. Ken, my wife's brother, Ken Llewellyn, went under UNRWA auspices to Greece, where there was a relief program through UNRWA going, and he, as a medical doctor, transferred there. I think in the end we virtually had to pressurize the government into accepting, this is the Ethiopian government, that they had got to find permanent replacements. And so, I think in sadness, but also the knowledge that this was a stimulus for them to do something, we did start moving out. And I think the last to go were the Commandant, Richie Mounty, and myself. And that, I think, was in August, September 45. That was after VE Day, but before VJ Day. Now, Richie Mounty, who, as I said in my letter, died tragically, has kept a very strong personal relationship with Ethiopia right through until the last few years. And I think his presence wasn't welcomed by the current powers, although he spent a lifetime and had trained, I suppose, half a dozen Ethiopian students at his own expense. And several other members of the unit did the same and brought over students and at their expense educated them. And in many cases they were, and these were all either orphans or paupers when found, and several of them have gone back, did go back, to be ministers in the Ethiopian government because they, of course, the UK education was highly prized. So that's...
How did you feel when you left Ethiopia? You know, did you feel you had had a satisfying experience there, you know, bearing in mind your aims at the beginning of the war?
Yes, I think I did. I think one feels, to a degree, frustration. But I personally felt, and I think it goes for many of the others, probably the vast majority of the others, they felt it had been a very interesting, stimulating part of their young lives, doing what, by their standards, was a lot of personal good. And I think many of them were stimulated to do medicine on their return. And I suppose four or five did carry on and qualify as doctors. So, yes, I think it was with satisfaction. Although, again, I think if one's honest, 3-4 years away, one's conscious of... one hasn't seen one's parents for 4 years. In my own case, I knew my father was very poorly and sick. So there's sadness in one sense, but also a relief that there's a job being done, just like, I suppose, the troops coming home from any overseas environment.
Did it change your life in any way? You know, you've explained...
Tremendously. I think... yes, I think it gave a view of the seamy side of life. I think it encouraged the self-reliance and independence, rather, the lack of dependence on I think the fact that you had to make big personal decisions which were contrary to the vast majority of your fellow human and be prepared to stand up and take whatever came of those. Most decisions since then have not been in that same category, and I think it did help one, you know. It made you realise that the vast majority of the world is on a mere survival basis, that life is very precarious. And I think it reinforces the view that, you know, one's got to keep striving. Sadly, I think the world since the last war, although there hasn't been a major war, it hasn't become a more pacific place, has it?
How about your own career? You know, you mentioned earlier on that you took up an interest in medicine.
Immediately I came back, I started to do my first MB. I applied to the government. There was a scheme where returning ex-servicemen who'd had their careers interrupted could apply for a government grant. And I applied to do medicine, citing my last 4 years medical work, saying, you know, big-headed, I'm half a doctor already, as it were, you know. And they replied and said, I'm sorry, we see that you were half a chartered accountant before you joined up for this work, and we'll give you a small grant to complete your studies as a chartered accountant. And I said, well, that's a pity, but I think in deference to my father, I qualified as a chartered accountant. He was keen that I should do that. But I did start immediately after qualifying as an accountant with the intention of already doing sort of night work to do the first MB. But then, lo and behold, on a quite accidental meeting with an ex-Ethiopian colleague, Dr. Ken Llewellyn, I bumped into him in London, and he took me home to his home, where lo and behold was his sister, and a romance started. And then all idea of a 5-year medical course disappeared with that decision. But it came in usefully, the medical background, because I suppose what a year after returning from 2 years after returning from Ethiopia, we were married and we went to South America, where we lived for another 2.5 years. And during that time, there was one of the worst earthquakes that South America has experienced. And my first aid medical knowledge came in very useful, because it was a territory very similar in the Andes to the highlands of Ethiopia. But when we came back, my career has been one in financial management, which, on reflection, I've quite enjoyed. But maybe, just to finish on the medical, I must have had some influence, because my son, who started off as an academic, after qualifying as an academic, he decided to do medicine and is now a family doctor. Maybe there was some rub off there.
That must be rather satisfying for you.
In a way, you're living a sort of surrogate second life through your son, which is very pleasing.
I wonder what you think of Ethiopia today, you know, when you see it's so much on the news, and I think today, you know, yesterday they had this pop aid, whatever it's
yes,
called.
Yes, yes, yes.
I wonder what you know you think of it.
Well, I think it's tragic. I know only what I read. I thought it was out of keeping and very barbaric the way they dispatched the emperor and his family. I don't know how far the Marxist regime there has dominated the people, but I suspect it probably has, although I do think that it did need a big change to get away from what was indisputably a feudal system. But probably there was a better way of doing that than the extreme brutality that seems to be going on. I think two factors have been against that regime, in fairness. One is that Tigray, which was a separate country and not part of the old Ethiopia, but was annexed, and I think Ethiopia may have been wrong in annexing it. And of course that's where the independence movement started, and that's been a sore thumb for 40 years now. So there's been basically civil war going on. And secondly, the factor which staggers me, but it happens right across the whole of that northern belt from Chad and right across, is this drought, which seems to be a permanent changing climate. And this has brought what was once, I think, comparatively fertile country into great desolation, which was an act not of man but of nature. Now, whether another administration backed immediately by the West could have done a better job, I don't know. But I think it is a great tragedy that the civil war and the drought have been confounding problems of whichever type of government was in power.
When you look at the pictures and read about it, do you ever think, you know, perhaps the FAU could be there doing something, you know, that there were lessons you learnt back in the 40s which could not be applied?
I would hope that at least they've got a medical service with trained doctors. I mean, I knew several of these people trained as doctors when they came, so they must have hundreds now of Ethiopian trained doctors. There were none when we were there. There's no doubt that Save the Children Fund, United Nations have got a lot of have given a lot of help. So I would imagine that in every place where we started a clinic, there is a clinic of some sort with, I would imagine, reasonably trained Ethiopian dressers or Ethiopian doctors. But I'm speaking without the book. Richie Mouncey, as I say, used to go back there every year, would have been able to tell you. But I haven't been back, so I really can't say.
How about all this aid which goes in? Do you think, you know, that that's the argument is that it's supporting the government, which is, you know, treating the people so badly? Do you have any feelings
about it?
No, I
think it's the old story, isn't it? You know, that if you've got those people there in the condition that they are, I think you forget what's brought them to that situation. You just say there are mouths to be felt and sickness to be cured. So, no, I don't. I mean, I think that the government, and that government in particular, would probably say, well, if the West won't help us, it means so many more million die. And they regard many of them as rebels anyway. So, I think it's absolutely right to give aid. And I do believe that usually good acts breed their own. They must feel that we're not all bad in spite of the propaganda they might get. Now, it's a fascinating country.
Could I ask you now about your pacifism today? You know, you explained earlier how, had you known the full extent of what Hitler was getting up to, well, you might well have felt differently. I wonder, you know, after the war, when you heard of things like that, and how it's developed through to today, you know, are you still a pacifist?
I think I'd answer that by saying I'm a pacifist in spirit. Whether I've got the strength of character to make the positive stand, as we did then, I doubt. I'm far less sure of the pacifist rightness. But what I am equally sure about is my own temperament and aspirations are still pacifist. That's not with the idea that pacifism can, as I once thought, cure most of the world's ills. In fact, I doubt if it can, and I think it becomes very much a highly personalized issue. But I think on a personal basis, I'm still a pacifist. If there's any solutions to be done, I'm equally sure now as I was then that military decisions as military decisions are not going to solve the problems of the world. So I'm in a limbo, if you like.
Do you still belong to the PPU?
No. And that's only tired indolence, I think. Their aspirations. Although I deplore some of the militancy sometimes that's gone on. I'm ostensibly still a member of the Church of England, although not as a regular churchgoer, but as someone who's been brought up and still hold dear the Christian religion, still drawn very much to the Quaker way of expressing it, although I'm not a Quaker, thinking that, well, I didn't disagree with the Church of England enough to resign. On the other hand, I think it's like so many members of the Church of England, it's part of the background there without great activity in it. We have these, as you know, these reunions. I still keep in contact with one or two of my old colleagues. But it is only part of life. It was a sort of 4 years of very impressionable youth. Good.
Do you feel pleased, though, that you were part of the FAU, that it was there to offer you that sort of service? You know?
Tremendously so. And I hope and will give every encouragement that similar organisations carry on, because, as I said earlier, you had to make a very, very big decision. What was clearly the biggest decision in your life at that stage to do that. There's no doubt at all it would have been far easier just to have said, right, I've been called up and that's it, for whatever motives. You didn't have to do anything that 90% of all your colleagues did. So I think you knew the consequences of doing this. I think it brought a sense of maturity, and the fact that at the end of the day you had to stand up and be counted for what you believed in. And all that, I feel, is good for whatever decision, you know, for whatever reasons you do that.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Tom, for telling me so many of your experiences.
Okay.
Our first Ethiopian.
Good.